I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to a classic version of the Raptors Reaction Podcast. I'm your host, William Liu. I'm joined on this episode to recap the infamous win where the Raptors upset the 92-win, championship-winning Michael Jordan's Bulls with one of the oldest Raptors fans I know, Zarar. How you doing?
I'm good, man. I didn't watch the game, so I know what we're going to recap here. If it's going off my memory, then I think all I remember is Jordan missing that jumper at the end and just walking off the court, acknowledging the loser that he is.
Wow. Okay, so first off, let's set the scene, all right? So this game took place March 24th, 1996. For me personally, I was 3 years old. I was living in Tianjin in China. I don't have any recollection of anything from that day. Zarar, where were you during this day?
I was in Kansas City, Missouri, because I used to live there. And obviously, I was a Raptor fan because I was moving to Canada that year. So I had started following the team because there was a new basketball team there. And I was, I was getting ready. So Raptor games were really hard to find. But one station that used to air that, air Bulls games, was WGN. I think they even still might mm-hmm. do that because they had a contract of airing Bulls games. And this was, I'm pretty sure this was the 72-10 season for the Bulls, where they at the time set the record for most wins. And to me, they still hold the record for most wins because the 73-9 by the Warriors doesn't mean shit because they lost in the finals. So you can throw that out, erase the history books, doesn't really matter. But this one was all about, would they hit 70 wins? And I remember, I was also a Bulls fan at the time because, I like Jordan and all that. But I do remember watching this game on, at the time, WGN or whatever the Bulls station was. And the Raptors just stuck around in this game. They were never out of it. And I think the Bulls were, I think they had won like 9 or 10 in a row coming into this one. Wasn't it something like that? And I remember not so much the game, but remembering at season's end that we are the reason that the Bulls were held to double digit losses, because that win, if we had not won that game, we would have actually, they would have been 73-9 and had single digit losses. But because of the Raptors, it was that they came into double digits, and that was a huge accomplishment in itself for me, knowing that we put a little bit of dent in the Bulls season. And I think if I go off, this is completely based on memory, I think the Bulls were going to finish with 9 wins or 9 losses that year, except they lost to Charlotte and Glenn Rice caught fire, and they lost a home game late in the season to make it 10 losses. But the game itself, man, I think Jordan's last shot is what I remember the most. And that's the main thing. And I think Kukoc had a pretty good game, if I remember. Kukoc is one of my favorite players growing up, because he was like the first of his generation, kind of his type of player, the tall, lanky, can dribble the ball, power forward type guy, tall, can shoot, not so much a great rebounder, but could do a lot of other things. And he was a guy I used to always keep my eye on. I remember him having a pretty decent game. Maybe I should pull up the stats to make sure I'm not a complete idiot, but I remember him having a decent game. I think at the time there was also a little bit of tension on the Bulls, where Kukoc was getting a lot of playing time, and Scottie Pippen was never a big fan of Kukoc, so I was always keeping an eye on that dynamic as well.
This is, I gotta say, incredible memory for something that happened like 26 years ago now, or 25 years ago. But okay, so let's set the scene. So to say this is an upset is an understatement. The Raptors, after this game, were 18-49. This is their inaugural season. And the Bulls, after this game, were 60-8. You're absolutely correct. There was a loss later, a one-point loss later in the season to Charlotte. that dropped them to 9 losses, but they also had their 10th loss, the second last game of the year, another 1-point loss to the Indiana Pacers. So that's actually super impressive to me that even though this team had 10 losses, most of the 10 losses were like really, really close. And this one, the Raptors win 109-108. Let's start at the end. So the Raptors, as you mentioned, were in this game. They were competing. I was actually pleasantly surprised considering I just kind of in my mind mentally thought everybody on the Raptors was trash. I don't know why I thought this, but when I watched the game, I was like, I'm pretty impressed by pretty much everyone in the game except for Alvar Robertson, who just didn't do anything. He was supposed to be the guy they put on Jordan to defend him. Jordan just torched him at the end, and it was a close game. Basically, the Raptors were up slightly midway through the fourth quarter. And MJ at this point, and if you watch the Raptor broadcast, which was with a very, very young Rod Black and a young Leo Routens on CTV, Leo mentions, hey, Michael Jordan's been really, really, really quiet. Hopefully let's not wake him up. And then all of a sudden, midway through the fourth quarter, MJ goes into that superstar mode, starts taking over. And I really wrote down a possession-by-possession breakdown just because of how amazing he did. But he went for a post-up finish and one, a low-post turnaround jumper, a high-post turnaround jumper, a mid-post turnaround jumper. He was fouled on a turnaround jumper by Alvin Robertson. He hits 2 free throws. And then 106-106, 31 seconds left, he gets the ball on the baseline and hits a turnaround jumper with 3 guys on him. I'm pretty sure Tracy Murray... It was Robertson was there, Doug Christie was there, and Tracy Murray came in with a late contest, and MJ hit that one as well. So he had 13 points from the middle of the fourth quarter onward, and it was like, holy shit, this guy is a superstar. It's unstoppable. Even watching it back, like, there's no misses in that stretch. That's the crazy part. He did not miss during that stretch. MJ was so, so good. I mean, for me, I didn't watch a lot of MJ, so seeing this back and seeing it live, like, it's actually true. He really is the GOAT.
Yeah, Jordan was, what am I going to say about Jordan? But I remember the shot that he missed against the Raptors is pretty much the same shot he made in the All-Star game when he came back as part of the Wizards. Okay. It was the game that would have won the All-Star game and given him the MVP. But Kobe Bryant in the All-Star game on the next possession actually drew a foul. Like, he actually made a pump fake just to draw a foul to take away that shine from Jordan. So when Jordan hit that shot in the All-Star game, immediately my mind went back to this game, and I that's the same shot that he missed against the Raptors. So it was a weird, 20 years apart, not 20, like, what am I saying, like 7-8 years apart. Mm-hmm. A scene that kind of drew itself. But I also remember in this game that again, I think you've watched it like 10 minutes ago, I think Damon had a move where he completely shook Ron Harper, and Harper fell on the ground.
Yep. No, God. Damon Stoudemire was a legend in this game. I mean, not as good as MJ was in this game, but definitely the second best player in the game, which is impressive because Scotty and Kukoc and all these other great players played in it. But
Damon was, we always talk about like what if that person had played in this era, or who would have stayed, like what if Tracy McGrady had stayed with the Raptors and paired up with Vince, what would have happened? Like, with those are like right now, like with the COVID thing going on, I see I've been doing the morning coffees for the site, and like half the articles are about like, what if, but nobody really talks about like, what if Damon had actually stuck around as part of the Raptors and actually not bolted the next year and been part of the Vince core and the Tracy McGrady thing. He would have been a major compliment to those guys. But that trajectory, nobody has quite really followed because he kind of wanted out the year after the Bulls game. But that is an interesting hypothetical.
Why did he want out?
The team just kind of sucked, man. And also, we had a really, really bad coach. Darryl Walker was... the worst Raptors coach we've had by a stretch, far worse than Kevin O'Neill was. He was not a player's coach or an X's and O's coach or any sort of coach. He just happened to be. I don't even know how he got into that position. I think Brendan Malone left or something happened.
Okay.
Bad coach, and also a coach that kind of held grudges against young players. I remember Darryl Walker in the middle of a season that was going nowhere. The Raptors won 16 games that year. He would not play Tracy McGrady.
Okay.
Tracy, like, he just would not play him, even though There was nothing to be had in that season. McGrady was a rookie. He called him lazy or something like that. Did not understand players. Like, McGrady was one of the first high school players to come out, you know, first, second or third maybe. And Walker just did not know how to manage him. And I can imagine that probably, like, you know, suffocated the locker room and had all kinds of, like, bad chemistry there. So I can understand Damon not wanting to be a part of it. And then he got shipped to Portland. So at the time, I don't think anybody blamed – well, anybody. There weren't that many Raptor fans around, but all eight Raptor fans did not blame Damon Sotomayor for leaving the Raptors at the time.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that has come up with now the Jordan doc coming out. And even just in the first two episodes, the kind of decisions and how open people – the players were in terms of just – their problems with the teams, and of course, just like the teams just seemed way more comically dysfunctional back then than they were now. Mm-hmm. It's like, why would the GM start to get into a beef with Phil Jackson, of all people, and then sign him to a one-year deal? You don't see any coaches sign to one-year deals anymore. I mean
there's a classic line from Jerry, was it Reinsdorf or Krause, who goes, organizations win championships.
Yeah.
Right? Yep. Not players. And Jordan threw that back at him, I think, when he had after the flu game, he goes, "Yeah, I didn't see the organization out there guarding whoever." So I mean, it was definitely more open and more whatever. But can you imagine, like, if you had the exposure that like Twitter and social media brings us at the time? When I kind of pulled that thread in my head a little bit, like, what would have happened if we had Twitter back then? And I think people would have watched what they said more. And we would not have been as open. When this Jordan doc came out, man, I was actually shocked that Jordan allowed this to even be recorded at the time. He must have, like, put, like, all kinds of conditions that I got to approve every single second that goes on if you're going to release this stuff. So the fact that we're able to record it is in itself a feat.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I hope Jordan got a lot of money out of this thing, because this thing is all people are talking about. And to your point about social media, like, this is why, and we'll get back to this game in a second, the Raptors really had an incredible win, but this is partially why the doc is so successful, is because there was no social media at the time, all these stories getting presented in real time, it's been really fun just to follow along and see the jokes and stuff like that. I think to me, honestly, one thing that kind of stood out was, like, Scotty seemed like, not sensitive to things, but just, like, perceptive in a way that almost reminded me of KD. You know, like KD in the modern era, you know, making burner accounts, stuff like that. I feel like Scotty might have made burner accounts just based on his, you know, portrayal.
That's interesting. So Scotty was, Scotty's an interesting, because he was severely underpaid.
It was comical. Criminal.
I haven't watched the first two episodes. I'm going to binge watch them all this weekend because I actually found eight episodes online. So Scotty was tremendously underpaid. Jerry Krause did not renegotiate his contract, even though it was very evident that he was underpaid. It's not like the Bulls didn't have money or didn't have, like, quote unquote cap space, or he just didn't want to renegotiate his deal. Mm-hmm. It was simple as that. And so when Scotty went to Houston, was it Houston? Yeah, Houston he went to after he left the Bulls. So I was happy that he got some of his money back. Would he have created burner accounts? That's an interesting one. I don't think Scotty was the type of person that would have done that, because he had I think he had more balls in him than people gave him credit for.
Okay.
When Jordan left, he could have easily bolted and gone to some other team where he could have maybe, at that time, players didn't just leave teams and, you know, start their own. But he had the opportunity to do that. He didn't do that. He stuck around. He stayed with the Bulls. I think he signed his deal. And he wanted to be number one. So it's not like he shied away from confrontation or pressure or anything like that. He wanted to be part of it. Did Scott, the one unanswered question that I always had is that, did it bother Scotty that he didn't get the attention that Jordan did, or did he not get the attention that he thought he deserved? If it did, I don't know if it ever reflected on the court in his play. The only moment that I can think of where I was like, man, Scotty, you cannot possibly do that, is when Jordan was retired. Mm-hmm. And the Bulls were playing the Knicks in the playoff series. The Bulls were down one, and Scotty and Kukoc were there. And Phil Jackson drew the final play up for Kukoc and asked Scotty to be the decoy.
Mm-hmm.
And Scotty refused to get off the bench. Like, he wouldn't get into the game. And that was a big moment on, you know, national TV. And, like, what the hell is Pippen doing? That's not leadership. It did not help that Kukoc hit the fadeaway game winner as time expired to beat the Knicks. So that was my main Scotty moment of, like, man, what are you doing? Other than that, man, I do not have any complaints about Scotty.
Okay, okay. To be fair, I've only seen two episodes of this Jordan doc, so I don't really know that much about Scotty. All right, back to this game. So, the ending of this game. So, I mentioned that MJ was going nuts. He had 13 points in about a five-minute span, all on ridiculously difficult turnaround jumpers, making shot after shot. And, you know, it looked like he was destined to win this game. And the history here is that the Raptors actually hosted Chicago earlier that season, and it was a very close game, that one too. But the Bulls won 92-89. MJ has 38, and apparently he scored a bunch of clutch baskets to win the game that time. So it seemed like the same script was playing out, except even after MJ put the Bulls up two with 31 seconds left, the Raptors, shout out Brendan Malone, great play. He draws up a curl for Tracy Murray, coming basically from the top of the floor down to the baseline off a couple of screens. And I guess the Bulls must have miscommunicated, because Murray is able to get the inbound pass and immediately tie the game with a layup. So not only was it a great play to tie the game, but it actually gave the Raptors a 2-for-1 opportunity where they get the ball back. Now, everyone knew that the ball was going to go to MJ, and MJ did get the ball. He brought the ball up the floor. He was going to attack. He was going to score. It was going to be game over, and people were going to be, you know, I mean, actually, people are probably pretty happy to see a game, MJ game winner. Except, Oliver Miller was able to recover after MJ beat Doug Christie on a spin move, completely beat him, and Oliver Miller ends up blocking MJ at the rim, kind of from behind, but still blocked him at the rim, collected the rebound, and then MJ, out of frustration, fouled. Well, not even frustration. There was no time left on the shot clock, but it was a tie game, but it was a mistake. He fouls Oliver Miller. He goes to the free throw line, splits one or two free throws. And then, you know, the Bulls had the last possession. MJ has a chance to win it. To be honest, the Raptors kind of swarmed it. They forced the ball out of his hands. It went to Scotty. He passed it to Steve Kerr. Steve Kerr had a semi-open look, pretty deep three. He missed it. And as you mentioned, MJ collects the ball right after the buzzer sounded. He gets the offensive rebound and hits this turnaround bank shot from the baseline that somehow falls in. But it was like maybe a second after the game had ended. So, first off, what are we going to say?
No. First off, what? Let's hear this, because I'm waiting for this first off now.
First off, how talented and how good was Oliver Miller? Because I watched this game in complete awe of this man.
No, he was not very good, man. He was just big. He was just big and round, and he reminded me of Monty Scott, who I play basketball with in my Monday night league sometimes. He's just round and has a basically girth around him, so he clears out space just by existing, and that allows him to get some rebounds. I think that was Oliver Miller's main strength. I don't think he was he was a tremendous player. I thought Reggie Slater was a much, much better player than Oliver Miller was. And I think Reggie Slater, who was, I don't know if he played in this game or not, but
he must have been sidelined. Only seven players played.
Playoff rotation for this one for the Raptors. But a couple of things you mentioned there, right? One thing you said was like difficult shots by Jordan. Those aren't difficult shots. That's Jordan's patented move. At that time, the fadeaway obviously existed well before him, but when he came out in post-retirement, he made the fadeaway an actual go-to move that future players like Kobe built their game around. So even though it may look like a difficult shot for us, or when you're looking at it, he's fading away, he's sometimes on one leg, that was his bread and butter. Like that's a shot that you don't want to give Jordan almost in that era. So to him, it was what the shot that he wanted. And the second thing you said was like the first game against the Bulls, how the Raptors always also played them close in that one. If that Bulls team or that second era Bulls team had a weakness, it was that they didn't have B.J. Armstrong or a above average point guard to run the show. Because in their first three-peat, they had B.J. Armstrong who ran the point. In their second iteration, they did not have that, and they relied on Ron Harper who was not as quick, who could not really shoot, mm-hmm. who was a decent defensive player, but had a lot of trouble against quicker point guards.
Yeah.
So if you watch any Bulls game in that era, you'll find that opposing point guards really, really gave them a lot of trouble. And Damon was that. Damon gave Ron Harper a lot of trouble, which forced help from a lot of different places, and it threw the Bulls off. It's not just limited to Damon. Any Bulls game in that era, small, quick point guards were the ones that gave him the most trouble.
Hmm. And you know, this is something that threw me off, too. I thought it was mostly a sign of respect, but the Bulls actually opened the game with Michael Jordan guarding Damon Stoudemire. And that was the only time Damon wasn't really scoring.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, throughout the course of the game, it was Ron Harper that got most of the assignment. He looked really old. I think he was in his mid-30s at this point, which back then was just meant you were just done. And then off the bench, it was Steve Kerr. And Steve Kerr had an amazing game shooting-wise, but Steve Kerr is not a defender whatsoever. And it was actually funny just to see, A, how small Damon Stoudemire was, but just also how small Steve Kerr was. I can't believe Steve Kerr was as successful as he was at that size, because it just seems like he's such a clear defensive liability, but he's part of so many championship teams, not just as a coach, but as a player. He just seemed like a huge defensive liability. But okay, so Oliver Miller, he's not an amazing player. This is really, again, I've only seen one game from this season, so to me...
No, Oliver Miller is not an amazing player. Yeah. You can put that on the record here, and I can confirm that for you. Oliver Miller was given the nature of the team, he was basically an expansion player. Okay. If I look at that roster, I think you sent me a link while we were talking. I think at the time, our best player obviously was Damon Stoudemire, and then there were some hopes that Carlos Rogers would develop into something more, right? He was the guy that may have had a higher ceiling than what it turned out to be. So I'm trying to think of like a Raptors comparison, like a small forward or a small / power forward who we maybe had high hopes for, who didn't really quite pan out. Mm. He was that type of player. And then the other consistent dude on that team was Tracy Murray, who was a scorer.
Right, right. He was good enough.
And Murray was generally a decent player in most games he played, I always thought. And then also Doug Christie was our second or third best player after that.
Yeah.
Not Oliver Miller.
Okay, well, this must have been a career game for Oliver Miller, because he has 14 points, 12 rebounds, including 6 offensive, 5 assists, 2 steals, and a block, the game-winning block, really, on MJ. Yeah, I just, you know, I heard the jokes about him, and yeah, I mean, you know, he was like just, you don't see players of his size, his archetype anymore in the NBA. They're pretty much just like all the big men nowadays are all pretty skinny.
His archetype? Did you say the Oliver Miller archetype?
Yeah, how many?
Oliver Miller archetype is found at your local McDonald's. Not on an NBA court.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much. But you know what, though?
A fun fact about Oliver Miller was sentenced to jail for pistoling somebody.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, okay. Again, like I said earlier, 90s basketball just was wilder than it is today by far. A couple things. Oliver Miller, I thought, pretty good passer. Had some really nice big-to-big passes. Even had some passes from the perimeter, which was, I think, pretty rare for big men back then, just to be even on the perimeter. Throughout the course of the game, Leo Rowden says, Oliver Miller's been averaging 11, 10, and 8 assists over his last 3 games. And I'm thinking, what? Who is this man? He also had great end-to-end inbound passes. You know, like the Kevin Love kind of passes or whatever. But since he was so strong, like, he could just, it was like effortless for him to just throw the ball like the whole length of the floor. And despite him at his size, he could still dunk. And he was going to fight Bill Wennington at some point, too. Like, great game.
Canadian Bill Wennington. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so...
Yeah, I mean, it's a good game. And I think... Did John Sally play in this game?
He did.
For the Bulls? Mm-hmm. For the Bulls, right? Didn't John Sally play for the Raptors at some point, or no?
He did.
Am I losing my mind here?
Well, I mean, I don't remember this, but in the broadcast they mentioned that John Sally was a rotation player for the Raptors early on because he got expansion drafted to the team. Then he got benched, and then he got really upset, forced his way out of the team, and then he went to the Bulls. And I didn't think he was that good in this game. He just seemed like a hustle guy, which is kind of how I remember John Sally, but... But, you know, really, everyone in the Raptors, and this is why the Raptors won, because they needed everyone to be good, but everyone on the Raptors did really well. Going back to Damon Stoudemire, 30 points, 4 rebounds, 11 assists. He's definitely the first star of this game. He played 46 out of 48 minutes, which, again, just
LeBron
doesn't,
minutes.
Doesn't happen in the NBA nowadays. I didn't know Damon Stoudemire was such a good shooter. 6 of 8 from 3, like a lot of just pull-up threes and big ones to stop momentum. He's
yeah,
very skilled.
Man, he very good pull-up game. I think the when he sent Harper to the floor, it was a pull-up move again.
Right.
Good in transition too. I think he had the ability to kind of like go, it's kind of like what Kyle Lowry does sometimes. Like, you know, like he like pull up from a little bit deeper than you think, and he'll drain it. Damon had that in him too. Also a good spot-up shooter, mm-hmm. and good finish. Just a good point guard. At the same time, he just loves smoking weed. Just loved smoking weed. Just loved it, and you know, which is great. I mean, good for him, and I mean, a lot of benefits to that. Uh-huh. But you know, he can't have interfere that with the basketball thing, right? So that's what happened to him in Portland.
Well, I mean, listen, I've been to Portland, and it's good out there. Damon Stoudemire, yeah, he won Rookie of the Year this year. 19 points, 9.3 assists per game, 4 rebounds as a rookie. Shot it pretty efficiently too, so. That's really impressive. I thought he was amazing in this one. Definitely a lot of highlights. He's number one star. I've already talked about Oliver Miller. He's the second star for me just because of the clutch plays he made. He also hit the game-winning free throw as well. But really, some of these other guys. So Carlos Rogers, he wasn't good? Because he looked really good in this one. Like really
No,
athletic.
He was.
He was good.
He was good. Like,
okay.
Like for sure. He was like an athletic, never had a great jumper, but who had a great jumper at that time? It was more of a slashing game. For sure, a decent player. Enjoyed watching him. Again, as I said, like he was one of the guys that that we kind of hoped would turn into like something great. Or not something great, something half decent. But about Damon Stoudemire, did you know that when the Raptors drafted him, there was a chorus of boos because a lot of fans wanted to draft Ed O'Bannon from UCLA.
I did not know this.
Yeah. That was a big, you know, that was a JV Kemba Walker decision of that era. It was the Ed O'Bannon and Damon.
Yeah, I mean, was Ed O'Bannon any good? Because I know him now for the NCAA lawsuits, and that's very cool that he's decided to head that up. And it's unfortunate that he got exploited that way, but was he good as an NBA player?
No, I think he stuck around for maybe 1 or 2 years. No,
oh, okay.
he didn't make it.
All yeah. right, fair enough.
If that, I don't even remember that. But he's a foggy memory on an NBA box score somewhere.
Okay. Yeah, Carlos Rogers, I thought it was interesting. I mean, he started the game by picking off a pass by MJ and then going the other way and throwing down a dunk. He had multiple dunks in this one. Had some like Marc Gasol-esque bounce passes that I really was not expecting. He blocked Tony Kukoc at the rim. And honestly, it felt like, because he kind of just like stopped playing in the game because he was really one of the Raptors' best players in the first half. But in the second half, he didn't really factor in. He had a couple of fouls. And really, John Tabak really took over in the second. And we can talk about
him. Yes.
But
yeah, can we talk about Zan Tabak a little bit?
Yeah, go ahead.
Because Zan Tabak had I'm looking at the box score finally, 6 of 11 for 12 points.
Uh-huh.
And Zan Tabak had a very uncanny skill.
Okay.
And his skill was that when he tried to shoot the ball, everybody froze. Because they did not expect Zan Tabak to shoot, let alone make the shot.
Okay.
So anytime he took like a face-up jumper, everybody kind of held their breath because it was so like untoward or so odd that this guy was even shooting that everybody kind of just paused. I'm talking about the fans here, not the players. Maybe uh-huh. even the players. Who knows? And I was a half decent Zan Tabak fan. In fact, there were a bunch of blogs early on called one of the blogs was called the Zan Tabak Herald.
Okay.
And the Zan Tabak Herald chronicled Zan Tabak's game. I tried to find it right now, but I can't seem to get it. But yeah, Zan Tabak was a bit of a cult hero at the time, far more than Carlos Rogers. Carlos Rogers was more the, like, if you will, the media darling who the Raptors want you to follow. But Zan Tabak had its own his own following. He was a master of the dark arts.
Okay. Yeah, the only other thing I was going to say about Carlos Rogers before going on to Zan Tabak was it felt like, did he have anger issues? Like, was he just like a very petulant player? Because it felt like he was pouting a lot in this game. And the broadcast mic was also really good, so you can hear a lot of sideline conversations. So he swore quite a bit, which was really picked up. I'm not really sure about this. Was he a petulant player?
No, I wouldn't. I mean, my this is like years back, but I don't remember him being petulant. I remember him being a little bit lazy on the defensive side. I think that might be the main criticism of Rodgers I had. And I think sometimes the franchise had kind of built him to be, you know, like a leading player, and he wasn't. So maybe that kind of got to his head a little bit. But at the end of the day, Will, we're talking about very, very average NBA players who, you know, would not be starting on most other teams. And here you are on an expansion team and you have a bit of a light. So, you know, that's just how it goes.
All right. Well, his counterpart and his backup power forward, Zonta Bach, first off, really good hook shot. Definitely, I mean, I only watched him in this game, but every single time he got the ball, he would fake left and then go up with the right hook. It was almost JV-esque, very predictable in that front, but surprisingly good with it because he's so tall that he could kind of lean in, and he had some soft touch. He also came up with some very clutch baskets in the fourth quarter, just like some garbage time, like not just garbage buckets, like hustle and stuff like that. And it was also interesting because he was Croatian, Kukoc was Croatian, so there's a bit of a battle there between the two of them. I would say they actually kind of went even, which is a win for the Raptors. And then really the only two guys, I mean, Tracy Murray we talked about, I mean, he was a good scorer. I didn't really see that much out of him today or in this game. But the last guy I want to talk about was Doug Christie, who I was surprised. Why was he coming off the bench? He seemed really good.
When I look at the box score now, it is kind of weird why he's coming off the bench, because not only would you start him, but you would also put him on Jordan.
Yes.
He was our best wing for not just this year, but for a number of years. I think he was, or I think he got traded, what, 2 years after, the next year or whatever. Yeah. But he was always our best backcourt defensive player. So I would have totally expected him to guard Jordan, and I'm pretty sure he did for a majority of that game. Doug was solid. He developed a good 3-point shot in his last year with the Raptors. I think eventually got shipped to Sacramento, maybe.
Yep.
I think the thing with Doug was that he was the only guy who was kind of known a little bit off the court at the time.
Oh yeah, yeah, right.
Yeah,
I've heard some of the stories.
Yeah, because his wife used to own him.
Right.
Like, right. He jumped as high as, what's that saying? You know, you jump, you say how high or whatever. Yeah, his wife absolutely owned him. I think they moved to Sacramento because she one day decided that, you know, like, she's done with this, and Doug had no choice. And there you go.
All right.
The Raptors have had a bunch of powerful wives. I think Antonio Davis, Kendra Davis comes to mind. Remember her?
No, you don't
remember that?
No. This is why the Classic Reaction Podcast is going to work great, because I haven't watched like half the Raptor seasons at least. So there's a lot learning and stuff. This is good.
Yeah. So Antonio Davis's wife thought she had a broadcast career in Toronto, and she wanted to be a media personality. Okay. This is again pre-Twitter and all that, and that was one of the, like, I think one of the reasons that he agreed to come to Toronto was that, and maybe I think even re-signed here, and it was one of those things, but it never really happened. The Raptors even, I think, gave her some sort of a show or some sort of a some spot somewhere to make her way, but it did not happen. And it did not help that she also got into it with a lot of the fans and while she was at the game, and it was just a mess. And then eventually, like, Davis left.
Right. All I remember from Antonio Davis, I mean, aside from like watching highlight clips and stuff like that, was like he gave a quote where he said he didn't want his kids to be learning the metric system.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is like, come on, what kind of reason is that?
Oh, God. Yeah.
How do the Raptors have all these problems? I don't understand. This is such unprofessional things to like conduct the players and stuff like that with. How do you even
as
a fan?
Like that kind of. Like that kind of mentality just bugs me, right? It just speaks of like just ignorance, right? So that's why when about a few months ago that Chris Bosh interview came out with some podcast somewhere, and he's complaining about, hey man, you know, like it takes you like
15 minutes in customs every time, and you multiply that by like 41, and that's like, I don't know, man, that's like 4 hours. Can you imagine 4 hours? And I'm like, no, shut up, man. Just shut up.
Yeah, okay,
like,
first off, it doesn't even take 15 minutes, man. They just sign a paper on their way off the plane.
Yeah, well, are you going in the wrong line? The machine's got a problem? You're not taking the picture right? Like, something's wrong with them.
Yeah, no, it takes a very long time for that that picture taker at that Pearson to reach up to 6'11".
Shout out to Pearson for streamlining some of that process at the airport. It's mostly digital now, so kudos to them. Yeah.
All right. Well, got a quick shout out. Okay, cool. So in classic reaction podcast fashion, I got to give out 3 stars and a Gerald Henderson Award. So the first star, obviously, is Damian Sotomayor, 30 points, 11 assists, 4 rebounds, 11 of 21 shooting, 6 of 8 from 3. Really some great highlights from this one. It was very impressive. I think this, at the time for him, was a career high. Second star, I'm giving that to Oliver Miller. Zarara, you have no say in this. 14 points, 12 rebounds, 5 assists, 2 steals, a block. Mm-hmm. If you block MJ and then hit the game-winning free throw, I don't care what presentation you come in. Big shout-out to Oliver Miller. Third star, now that you have the box score, you want to pick a third star from this game?
Well, who was guarding MJ on that last shot?
I think it was a lot of Alvin Robertson or Doug Christie.
Yeah, so I'm going to – so my third star was going to be a guard who was guarding. And I think it was a double at the time, and I think Christie was there. So I'm going to give it to Doug Christie because he was also 3 for 3 in this game, very efficient game. And I remember him just guarding Jordan for a bunch of it. So even though Jordan had like, what, I don't know, how many did he have here?
36
points.
Jeez.
Hey, man, you know, that's containment.
I guess so. I guess so. Oh, man, MJ was so good. It was nuts. Like, it's like every time he got the ball, it was inevitable. Yeah. He was going to score. Like, he didn't really have misses. Like, unless you really rushed the shot, doubled him, and then he forced one, like, he was not going to miss. It's kind of scary. And it also reminded me a little bit of, like, it was LeBron-esque in a way, just because, you know, and this is MJ in his bit of older years and stuff like that. He didn't really go all out, didn't really impose himself. He just picked and chose his spots. But every time he picked his spots, he would score, except for when he missed against Oliver Miller.
Jordan was a man. I mean, what? There's nothing to say about him. I think you appreciated Jordan a lot because he was a guy who changed his game midway through his career as he got older. I think that's something that you have to respect in a lot of players, right? And a lot of the great ones will change their game because the defense adjusts, they get older, they lose some of their physical ability. But to remain dominant despite age and despite, you know, the competition knowing exactly what they expect is pretty impressive. It's like, I kind of make a comparison to like Tiger Woods. Similar, but a little different because Tiger, he was at the top of his game and he decided midway through his, when he was winning Masters and everything else, to actually change his drive completely. Like he actually went back to the bases because he goes, if I want to win like 10 more Masters or whatever it is, I need to change how I, this major facet of my game, which is already significantly above average, but how do I make it amazing? And he basically destroyed his drive, went back to the basics, and reinvented himself midway through his career. And Jordan, in that baseball time, came back and reinvented how he was going to dominate. Like you see players reinvent themselves, but it's rare that you see players reinvent themselves and dominate with their reinvention. Like completely dominating the league in two different, not eras, but like two different types of styles of play at least, right? The first was the electric Jordan, like, you know, like dunking and driving by people and just like making a fool out of Craig Elo every other year. And then you had this Jordan, which was like much more suave, much more fadeaway, much more calm, more on the, you know, a much better passer, I think higher EQ. So I think that's what stands out about Jordan.
Right. The Gerald Henderson Award for the random player that lit up the Raptors. I got to go with Steve Kerr here. Obviously, Steve Kerr is a very good player. They mentioned in the broadcast that Steve Kerr for that season during that time of the game was shooting 51% from three, 50% from the field, and 90% from the three-point line. That season, he finished 51% from the field, 52% from three, and 93% from the free throw line. So that's incredible. But yeah, Steve Kerr checked in and started just taking every single shot and hit 7 of 10, including 3 of 6 from 3 for 17 points. The only shot he missed was the semi-open shot that would have sank the Raptors at the end there. But Steve Kerr, really good player.
I'm going to go with Tony Kukoc because I like Tony Kukoc. And, right. But for Steve Kerr, did any of his shots, were they all like both feet on the ground set shots with somebody passing him the ball, or did he actually venture and actually do something to somewhat maybe sort of create his own shot?
Well,
I'm asking.
You know what? It's good that you asked that because obviously a lot of them were catch and shoot opportunities. And, you know, the Bulls, actually what really impressed me too was they had MJ, they had Scottie, they had Kukoc. All three of those guys can make a play and handle it and draw extra attention. And so if you had shooters around them, it was just incredible. But, and, you know, once Steve got really hot, like he was able to like dribble past against a tough closeout and really hit a contested shot. He had a couple of contested shots in this one, in the 2-point area that were really impressive for me. So I don't know. Steve was good.
When it came to shooters in that era, Steve, I mean, again, I was a Bulls fan. I mean, I love Steve Kerr. Love his game one winner against the Sonics and all that, or Jazz, whatever it was. But in terms of like did I enjoy watching Steve Kerr? Not so much. I mean, he wouldn't be a guy that I would like enjoy watching. The two shooters that I always loved watching in that era, one was Del Curry.
Okay.
Because Del Curry did not need to be balanced to get a shot off. Like the only thing that Del Curry needed was his elbows facing the right direction, and that's it. His body could be completely contorted, and he would be able to hit that shot, whether it's a leaner, whether it's a catch and shoot. He was basically Rip Hamilton, except not as maybe sophisticated in his movements, but very much able to pull up in transition, take weird shots, and still make them under pressure. An amazing shooter, great form, blah, blah, blah. The other guy that I used to like was the Rifleman, a Chuck Person. who was pretty good. And also Dale Ellis in that era, Seattle Sonics, another guy who used to like shoot it up from the corner. And also one more shout out to a shooter, not in this game, but Allen Houston, man.
Okay.
I still believe Allen Houston had the best looking jumper I have ever seen to date.
Okay. But, you know, honestly, the 3-point shot this era really didn't feel like that much of a weapon. Like, I actually really enjoyed watching this game. Just for the creative ways people would try to attack the basket. Like, it was always attack the basket first and foremost. Like, I think Steve Kerr pulled up for three in transition one time. And that was unique, but that was Steve Kerr. And he was shooting 50% from three. But, like, the Bulls only took 18 threes. The Raptors, despite hitting 11 of 17, only took 17 threes. It was nice to see people just, like, constantly run, like, baseline action, get low post position, big-to-big passing, you know, a lot of physical play, things like that. And I also kind of enjoyed the way it was officiated too, just because like there didn't feel like as many stoppages as there are today. You know what I mean? Like, there wasn't just like petty stuff like, oh, he grabbed them or whatever. It was just kind of like, whatever, play through it. If it's flagrant, then we'll call it. But, you know,
for sure. I mean, I think the East has always been even well, not so much in today's day and age, but the East has always been, I'd say, the more physical, slower conference as long as I've been watching basketball. I think if you go Bulls Knicks or any Bulls series, Bulls Heat Knicks, it's always been the slower type of half court game, and I enjoyed it. I think. The refs at the time, credit to them, they let a lot of things go. I said credit to them, but I don't know if that's a credit to them or whatever. But I certainly enjoyed that slower pace of basketball with less threes. But that's what made threes special. That's what made a guy like Tony Kukoc so special, because he did bring a dimension which, though today is common, at the time was considered like completely different. Like, he was a player that I think the only like similar comparisons to Tony Kukoc at the time were guys like Sam Perkins, Sleepy Sam Perkins. Okay. He used to have this like catapult shot, played for the Pacers for a bit, I think the Sonics as well. And there were maybe like two or three guys in the league that could do that, you know, and that's what made the 3-point shot so special, because when it did go in, it was like a big deal.
What's Tony Kukoc's 2020 NBA comparison?
I don't know, everybody.
Oh, okay.
I mean, literally, like, I mean, you can find, I don't know, man.
Like, if I said Hito Turkoglu with some real playoff wins, is that an insult?
Yes, that's a massive insult.
Okay, all right. I take that back.
Hito, at the end of the day, had like, you know, a couple of good years, and Kukoc was fairly consistent for a while.
Okay.
And Kukoc also had a pretty decent post-up game when he ended up in Milwaukee later on. So I think Kukoc was one of the people who maybe got shadowed because of, or overshadowed because of the team he was in.
Okay, interesting. Well, this has been great. This is the first episode of the Classic Raptors Reaction Podcast, or Raptors Reaction Podcast Classic. I'm not really sure which one sounds better. I have plans to do Game 7, the original Game 7 against Philly, next week, so you can listen for that. But if listeners, if you have a game that you would like to have me review or watch, please let me know. Please direct message me on Twitter, or just at me on Twitter, at William_Lou. And I will try my best to find footage. To be honest, finding old footage is incredibly difficult. The League Pass database only goes back to the 12-13 season. So that's the stuff that's easily accessible. Beyond that, it's going to be a little tough to find full footage, but I will do my best.
I got one for you. I mean, you can celebrate. You can celebrate the wins. Game 7, obviously, Philly is a big one. Game 5 against the Knicks is a massive one. But if you want to go on the darker side of the spectrum, Will.
What, Game 7's not dark enough against Philly?
Oh man, well, we're still in the playoffs. We're still like doing things, right? I mean, go to the season after our second season. The last game of the season is against Philadelphia at home. The Raptors at this point have drafted Marcus Camby, and they finished the season with 16 wins. The last game against Philly at home, Iverson has a massive, massive game, including throwing down an insane dunk, which you can probably find on YouTube still, over Marcus Camby on a rebound. And I think I've probably mentioned this on the podcast a couple times, but that game ended at the old Maple Leaf Gardens because the Sky Dome had an event or whatever.
What?
And then Glenn Grunwald came. And Glenn Grunwald came on the floor. No. Grunwald came to the floor with a mic in his hand, and he apologized to the fans for the product that was on the pitch.
Oh, my God.
I doubt you can find that speech. And that speech, man, always made me respect Grunwald because he acknowledged what the product was, and he made some moves to fix it.
You know, I've talked to Grunwald a couple times, so I might have just to call him for this, man.
Oh, yeah. He will 100% remember this one.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Zarar, for doing this. What do you want to plug? What do you want to shout out? Raptors Republic, of course.
No, I got nothing to plug.
Okay. All right.
Good.
Cool. Yeah. All right. Well, that does it for the podcast. Thanks, everyone, for listening. So if you have any more classic Raptor game suggestions, please let me know. And thanks again to Zarar for coming on the podcast.
See you, man.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there, especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.
Thank you. Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.